Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. It's time for another Warner Archive Collection podcast, and this one goes to 11 for 11 new additions to the Warner Archive Collection. First, one of our most requested, please bring this to Blu-ray movies, is finally coming to Blu-ray, and it is a seminal film noir. We have brought it back in print on DVD, but now we bring you in all its high-definition glory, Gun Crazy, directed by Joseph H. Lewis, released in 1949, also known as Deadly is the Female. Starring John Dahl and Peggy Cummings, this is one of the film noir films that really defines the genre, and we've got some special stuff on the disc to underscore that point. Moving on to DVD, we have a new to DVD television series, and this is a mere 53 years old. This is A Man Called Shenandoah, starring Robert Horton, from the 1965-66 season. This is an oft-request Western, and we'll be talking a lot more about that. It's the full series. It was one-season show, one and done, and we're excited to bring it to DVD. Also new to DVD are four films from the 1930s. We have two pre-code films, both from 1932, RKO's The Lost Squadron with Erich von Stroheim and Richard Dix, and the famous Ferguson case from 1932 with Warner Archive favorite Joan Blondell. Then from 1939, Dennis O'Keefe's Burn 'Em Up O'Connor. And last but not least from 1939, Joe McRae stars with Brenda Marshall in 1939's Espionage Agent. So those are the new to DVD and Blu-ray releases, but we're not done yet.
What?
Because we have titles back in print on DVD. Four Humphrey Bogart classics, Across the Pacific, Action in the North Atlantic, Passage to Marseille and Key Largo, and a very interesting television series from McG from the early aughts. Fast Lane, the complete series. It's been out of print for a while, and now you no longer have to be hoodwinked into outrageous prices to own this very interesting series.
You won't get a ticket when you're speeding.
That's right.
The candy store is back open.
Oh. So, gentlemen, let's start the podcast with an homage to one of our favorite film noir, finally on Blu-ray in glorious high definition, Joseph H. Lewis's Gun Crazy from 1949.
This is probably a classic film that is so classic it transcends not just film noir, but old movies into a modern masterpiece. Like, that, to me, this is one of these films that everyone should love.
It's a film that acclaim and importance has only grown with time.
Yes.
I mean, I had the privilege of seeing it for the first time in an actual movie theater at the Brattle, and from the opening shot, this is very, very, what's the word they use? Propulsive piece of cinema.
This is a piece of cinema that came out of the independent world and was a postcard to the future in terms of everything about it.
It still feels like a modern film.
And I think not just this film, but the genre itself.
Yes.
Film noir probably is the most resonant of genres of classic film that newer generations can relate to. And this was sort of a subject of academia and books in the 90s and 80s and in film school. I saw this in film school.
Yeah, this was a film school favorite.
It wasn't really until 2004 when we released this on DVD for the first time in our very first Warner Home Video Film Noir Classics collection that the film got such broad attention that it had deserved from, you know, the general public, because that first film noir set was such a sensation that it sent the competitors spinning trying to put out their film noir sets, which was great for the growth of noir. And in the last 14, 15 years, I've seen noir grow from a little bit of a cult.
Into a whole city.
Into a whole city. In which we know the mayor personally.
Yeah.
Eddie Muller.
From Noir City, and I just went to their 20th festival here in LA, and it was my privilege to see this film at the second festival, and it was explosive and was one of the best presentations of this kind of material that I'd seen here in LA, because this bridged, like, where you were saying, like, film school, and kind of got into Hollywood and into the spirit, and really lit a fire for me personally.
And then for fans of modern cinema, you know, if you, you know, sort of at the time that this film came out, people were very familiar with Bonnie and Clyde, mm-hmm. but not so familiar with Gun Crazy. Mm-hmm. And there's an enormous debt owed to Gun Crazy by Bonnie and Clyde. I'm not faulting Bonnie and Clyde. It's a great movie. But you can see there's the DNA of Gun Crazy is very much in Bonnie and Clyde.
Just speaking super broadly, this movie kind of sits, I would just say broadly, in people's heads as like an harbinger, not of the 50s, but the 60s.
And the 50s, because it has, it has the beat sensibility to it.
It does have the beat, but it almost like the camera work, style fluidity, and it takes this like huge leap ahead that it took a while for people to catch up halfway to. And this is my opinion.
And Joseph H. Lewis was not acclaimed as a great director during the period that this film came out. But when I went to film school, there was a whole class dedicated to his work.
Yeah.
He's one of those people like Jacques Tourneur, who are not the mainline directors like Cukor and Wellman and Raoul Walsh. And, you know, there's this second tier of directors that have elevated themselves. Their work has been elevated over the years because they have become the more interesting directors that expanded the boundaries of the Hollywood system. Now, to Matt's good point, this was an independent production of the King Brothers, and they made some very interesting films, some of which we've talked about in previous podcasts. And this was originally released by United Artists theatrically, and it was at the time when United Artists really functioned as a releasing organization for independent producers. But it ended up as part of the Monogram Film Library, and the Allied Artists / Monogram Film Library was purchased by Lorimar in 1979, and we purchased Lorimar about 9 or 10 years later, and that's how this film made a very circuitous journey to the Warner Brothers Library. But when we were putting together the first Film Noir Classics collection for DVD in 2004, as classic films on DVD were starting to become a market versus the new recent theatrical films, as it is with any new format that came along, the early adopters wanted the high technical,
the cutting
color,
edge,
widescreen, 5.1 sound. You know, black and white classic movies were late to the party in being accepted on DVD, but this Film Noir collection, which also included films like The Asphalt Jungle and Out of the Past and
Murder My Sweet,
which we had the good fortune to release on Blu-ray, Murder My Sweet and Out of the Past. Now we release Gun Crazy. The Criterion folks have released The Asphalt Jungle. And that leaves one left from...
Set 'em up.
The setup, which we do hope to bring to Blu-ray ourselves in the future. So that's something for you folks to look forward to. It's not a formal announcement.
Oh, okay.
We say we hope.
We hope, but hold on to the box, because then you could stick them back in.
That's right.
Which Dan does.
The important thing is that Gun Crazy came and went in 1949, 1950. There was the change of titles. And I believe if you go back into the Warner Archive Collection podcast history, you'll find a conversation that I had with Eddie Muller, the czar of noir, about our DVD reissue of this film through Warner Archive after it had gone out of print. And Eddie talks in detail. I think Eddie is the PMK, the person most knowledgeable about film noir, and he heads up the Film Noir Foundation, and now he's become a big TV star, but we knew him before then, and Eddie is the best advocate for this movie and spoke with me about it for one of our podcasts about 4 years ago, so look for that so we can get more detail than we have time to share with you here. In addition to the wonderful performances of the leading man and leading lady in this movie, also want to call out young Rusty Tamblyn, who was about 16, 15 years old when he played the younger version of John Dahl's character in this movie. And of course, Rusty Tamblyn went on to stardom in movies like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers in West Side Story, and of course, our own son of a gunfighter. So here's to Russ Campbell.
He's great in that opening. Great. I mean, this movie literally opens with a smash.
And it opens with a bang. And with guns being controversial in today's times, and they were always controversial,
yes,
basically, this film really deals with some very timely issues. And it is also quintessential entertainment because it is efficient storytelling in a very basic amount of time and is worth reviewing over and over again. Now you get to see it in Blu-ray, beautiful high definition, and a special shout out to the folks at UCLA who worked on a restoration of this movie a few years ago and contributed to this release. And to boot on this release, we have a 66-minute documentary called Darkness into Light, and It's about the history of film noir, and it has comments from lots of noir experts, filmmakers, and clips from many of the great film noir films in our library. And we also have a commentary track from the ever-wonderful Glenn Erickson, also known as DVD Savant, who has his own website now, yeah, Cine Savant. And Glenn is a former colleague of mine from my years at MGM when we worked together, and he's since gone on to become a hero and superstar on the internet. When we were gathering experts of film noir to talk about the releases on DVD, mm-hmm, Glenn seemed a perfect choice to talk about this film, yeah, and his commentary is here on the Blu-ray along with the feature-length documentary. So this is a fantastic opportunity to own the essential noir film.
And this film is so big in our hearts and minds. We've been talking about the film itself, but the presentation, which we haven't had much time, this is an incredible black and white presentation on this Blu-ray.
This is the best the fuzzy sweater, yeah, has ever looked.
And, you know, I've seen this in 35mm, and this is so present in my living room.
Well, and a lot of work went into making it look and sound as good as it could, and we're very proud of it. Now we go from the big screen to the small screen as we go to MGM Television, the year 1965. And the series was called A Man Called Shenandoah. This is a Western series that only lasted one season. It's a half-hour Western, which is kind of unique, not completely unusual, but it's very efficient in telling its stories. It doesn't drag at all, and it's very entertaining.
And it's worthy to note that, you know, Robert Horton, who had starred in a very famous TV show,
very long running,
and was a main star in that. When he left that show, he was like done with Westerns, mm-hmm, and it was the quality of the writing for Shenandoah that brought him back into
the show.
After leaving Wagon Train, he went back on the trail.
And there are a lot of famous guest stars in
this show. You know, this show is very similar in setup to a show that was made later that we've recently talked, yeah, about, Lazarus Man.
The Lazarus Man, the main difference is, of course, Robert Urich literally comes out of the grave.
But in both cases, we have a stoic, amnesiac Western hero trying to reclaim his past. So each episode,
defining himself as a man.
And each conflict and circumstance he steps in is unique to that episode. It's all right, standalone with a running thread of him trying to figure out who he is and where he came from.
Find clues to his identity. And, but he is a traveling angel, yeah, much like the Incredible Hulk.
And as such, you know, it's a mid-60s show, so you have just so many amazing guest stars. Particular interest, of course, to us would be both DeForest Kelly and Leonard Nimoy guest.
And
separately. DeForest Kelly is, of course, wonderful because it's a Western, and much like, yeah, Bones, he was meant to be in the West.
Damn it, Dan, you're right.
Ed Asner, Bruce Dern, Warren Oates, George Kennedy, Martin Landau, and one of my very favorite performers of all time, Mr. Frank Gorshin.
Now, I've always had a theory about this series and its lack of renewal or enough ratings to keep it going more than one season. And that is that in 1965, there was a huge hit film for Universal starring Jimmy Stewart called Shenandoah. Which has absolutely no relation to this. Yeah. And I think it was very confusing to people. Now, this is not based in anything I've ever read or heard, but I thought this was a really great show, and I couldn't understand why it didn't take off. And I think, yeah, that could be why, because Shenandoah was a big hit color film for Universal, set in the Civil War, and this is a very different story. So we really recommend you give this a look-see. This is the kind of television that's hard to see, and now you can own it and have it on your shelf forever. Now we move back to the big screen and some classics, and we start off with a 1932 RKO epic about movie making and about aeronautics and about battle of both personality and war. There's everything in here.
Hollywood.
Yeah. Now, this Lost Squadron is an amazing movie because it's a fighter pilot movie, World War One flying aces.
It's a historical film.
It's a historic film. It's also a film about the early days of cinema and filmmaking.
Yes.
It's an action movie.
A love story.
And we've got one of the most famous directors playing the famous director. And it's, of course,
an a-hole.
Yeah.
It's playing a stereotype.
A stereotype of himself. Like, we're talking about Eric von Stroheim, and he's great in the movie. The ensemble cast is great. We've got Richard Dix.
Yes, Richard Dix.
A very young Joel McRae.
Who is a wonderful, dashing lead.
Robert Armstrong. Mary Astor's in this.
Mary Astor.
And it's basically
the girl between.
It's a group of fighter pilots. Oh, and then we also have a bit of the sort of post, now be a PTSD story.
Yeah, it is a PTSD. It pretty much is that.
And so a group of pilots, forever scarred by war, attempt to return.
They're the last of the pilots of their squad.
They're flying when armistice is declared. Yeah. And there's a bit of a farewell exchange with a German pilot. And they attempt to reintegrate into the civilian world, and they all fail separately, when one of them finds some success as a stunt pilot in Hollywood and brings the gang back together just in time for them to go on the path of vengeance.
What is really fascinating about this is Hollywood did not make too many movies about Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have RKO making The Lost Squadron in 1932, which is, you know, the whole essence of von Stroheim playing a caricature of himself, where only less than a decade before he had directed what could be one of the greatest silent masterpieces, right. Greed. And he was also responsible for epic overruns of budget. And then years later, he would play a caricature of himself again in Sunset Boulevard. Yeah. So there's all these very, very strange conundrums, but it all comes together as a really amazing piece of film history, because you've got this convocation of great talents, storytelling, and this was not the only film that RKO made about the industry itself at that time, because What Price Hollywood,
right,
which was the basis of similarity to A Star Is Born, was also made around the same time. So you started having Hollywood turn the camera on itself just a little bit. And that was not the first time it had been done. It had been done before that. But this is really memorable because it is Hollywood taking a look at its legends and lore. And it's also, as you said, great entertainment.
Yeah. And it's pre-code through and through, which adds this extra little gloss to it, because as someone who wrote a book about giving the middle finger, this has one of the most iconic flying birds of all time, with an ironic send-off with a middle finger before a deadly air disaster.
The next film we're going to talk about is not a famous movie, but it should be. It's the famous Ferguson case, and this is a 1932 Warner Brothers pre-code in every sense of the word, and Joan Blondell is the center of attraction in this very interesting film.
If you're interested in fake news, famous Ferguson case is for you. Like a lot of pre-code films, one of the things about this film, which is that it's about a small town murder investigation that becomes front page news, and the more scandal, the better to move the more papers. The sensibility in the film, and especially in the dialogue, that you could remake this today without changing a word, except they'd be on computers instead of printing presses. There's some amazingly cynical stuff. For example, there's a murder, and the wife survives, and she tells a story about a home invasion, and the cops pretty much roll their eyes, as we do today.
Because they know, due to circumstances, that she was involved with another man.
And then there's a great line where Joan Blondell plays the experienced news hen from out of town, and there's a local news reporter / love interest for the main male character. And there's a line made, and then Joan turns and she says, "How old do you think I am?"
Yeah.
And I don't remember where, 18, 19, 20?
No, she was 23. She's like, I'm only 23.
This is the kind of movie that we ardently recommend because it is rare, hard to find. It's the essence of the Warner Archive mission statement, and now it can be yours to own. The next film we're going to talk about jumps out of the pre-Code era and very much into the post-Code era, and this is an MGM production called Burn 'Em Up, O'Connor, starring Dennis O'Keefe. It's from 1939, and this is one of those MGM films that feels like it could have been a Warner picture.
Yeah, very much. It's a
few years too late.
Well, like, it stars MGM's own Alan Jenkins, Nat Pendleton.
I've never heard of Nat Pendleton referred to quite that
way. We've had
such a run of Nat movies recently that I just feel like he's this year's Alan Jenkins. Although Alan, of course, will always be primary due to his multifaceted nature.
Script, we're somewhere else. Probably. To me, the center of this is midget racing. There is some incredible vintage racing footage here. And
can you explain what that is for people who don't know?
If you have a very, very tiny car at the time,
thank you.
They called it midget racing because of the tininess of the vehicle, not the drivers.
Thank you.
But these are tiny, dangerous go-karts that go 100 miles an hour. And let's just say, if somebody's eyesight perhaps is a little messed with, it ends in fiery death.
And it's interesting, in this case, although Nat Pendleton is still playing the Nat Pendleton type, this time he actually gets to also be a genius.
He is a genius.
And in real life, he actually was a genius, which a lot of people don't know.
I didn't know.
Yeah, chess champion.
Oh, well, he isn't a chess champion here, but no. He's a master mechanic.
Master mechanic. And
haven't you seen the movie Searching for Nat Pendleton?
And there's...
I would watch
there's
that.
It's a two-pronged film. We've got sort of the sports love story as mm-hmm. Dennis O'Keefe tries to get the hand of the daughter of the racing magnate, Cecilia Parker. But then there is a fatal accident and a mystery around that. And Nat Pendleton is our detective.
Now, our next film is a Warner Brothers film
and
has the unusual luxury of having Joel McRae on loan out, actually, to star in the leading role of espionage agent, co-starring Brenda Marshall.
Now, I've talked about this in the past, so if you've listened to the podcast, I apologize for going over old ground, but for some academics that felt that people at this studio in particular were somehow in bed with Adolf Hitler. This is one of the many films that Warner Brothers produced at the time, way ahead of schedule, that clearly showed that those brothers knew who the bad guy was.
This wasn't late 39.
Yeah.
You know, when it was obvious. But this is Warner Brothers preparing people for the Nazi onslaught and what will happen. And also, especially for 1939, a love story torn by diplomacy.
Joel McRae plays a career diplomat whose career takes a turn thanks to love that he didn't encounter, and then he is recruited by the State Department to be a one-man counter-espionage force. And that's where we get into the action part of the film, which very thoroughly confronts the evils of Nazi Germany at a time when other studios were perhaps afraid to.
His wife, who he met overseas, was compromised by the Germans, and they got married anyway. And then when that was uncovered, there was a scandal.
Dun-dun-dun.
He goes undercover.
And it was sort of remarkable about this film's script is, unlike modern screenwriting,
mm-hmm.
the film's plot is not dependent on people acting like idiots.
No.
His wife gets compromised and tells him, and then the two of them go and confess, and that gets us into the main plot.
Yeah.
As opposed to today, when they make the movie, they'd have her cover it up for 45 minutes.
Yeah, it wasn't like The Americans or something, seasons.
Don't forget, Warner Brothers was all about efficient storytelling.
Yeah.
Not wasting a frame of film, and this is a really... really, not unlike the famous Ferguson case. This is a film people don't talk about. They should, and it will be an eye-opener to a lot of people, so we highly recommend Espionage Agent from 1939. Now, very briefly, we're going to mention some films that are back in print on DVDs as individual items because they were out of print. Two of them are back as individual items on DVD, Across the Pacific and Action in the North Atlantic. They star Mr. Humphrey Bogart. And two of them are back as individual DVDs, but are also available on Blu-ray from the Warner Archive Collection. And if you have a Blu-ray player, you must own them. Passage to Marseille with Mr. Bogart and 1948's Key Largo with Mr. Bogart and his wife, Ms. Bacall, and Edward G. Robinson and Claire Trevor and Lionel Barrymore. Fantastic movie.
Yeah.
And for people who like to own their DVDs individually, that's now possible once again.
It's never bad to get a Bogart reminder.
No. And also, Back in Print is a really interesting television series from 2002-03 television season that has been out of print for a long time and really had an ardent fan following that was very disappointed when it got canceled after its only one-year run. Fastlane. And this was created by McGee, best known for the Charlie's Angels movie.
This TV series is kind of a fascinating document of its time. You can tell it's like McGee coming out of his music video time, and there's the Fast and Furious movies were taking off. And I don't know how to explain how 2002 it feels, but I love it because I have been transported to a world that actually doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly.
This high-octane downtown.
Yeah, actually, man, I have to correct you. There are certain offices in our building where it's still 2002. And that's a scary thought. Because
you might be right, though.
I know where those offices are. I know who sits in those offices.
Yeah.
Peter Facinelli and Bill Bellamy are the leads. They play two cops that basically use illegal search and seizure to fuel they behave as criminals in order to catch criminals, but they kind of are criminals.
They are criminals. They definitely abuse the law in ways that would not be looked upon kindly today.
And Tiffany Thiessen sort of plays their handler manages.
I'm a 90210 fan. I'm also a Nurse Jackie fan.
She manages the candy store, which is where all the cars and devices and things they get their hands on.
Which is now a wonderful vintage movie theater downtown, but apparently in 2002 it could just be where you keep your cars.
The criminals catch the criminals. And Tiffany Thiessen gets to give out the cars.
And it says, hey, you got to catch more criminals so we can afford more cars.
And we highly recommend this series to you. We also want to remind you that vintage television series as well as vintage films, great animation and soundtracks, as well as our 300-plus podcasts are all available at the Warner Archive iTunes room. You can go to itunes.com/Warner Archive, or if you're in iTunes on your Apple TV, you can go to the classic section and look for the Warner Archive swoosh at the bottom of the page and find that some of the greatest classics from the Warner Brothers Entertainment Library, from Gone with the Wind down to Gold Diggers of 1933 and 35, and even F Troop. Everything is there, along with great soundtracks from Water Tower Music, and of course, our podcasts that go all the way back to 2009, which are free, and you're listening to one right now. It's all in the Warner Archive iTunes room, so we urge you to make your digital purchases there and find more of our podcasts. Now, this is usually the portion of our podcast where we have the opportunity to share consumer letters with you, where people have taken the time to send us letters in the mail and have them read on our podcast. And in fact, this week we were all ready to read you not one, but two letters that we received this week.
Both of which came from overseas.
Now,
and both of which Matt forgot to bring to the podcast.
You might have heard a sharp intake of breath of mine. That's when I realized I had left the two letters on my desk. But we did get a social media letter, but we can read that. But before
we do that, we should let you know first of all, we apologize to the people who are kind enough to send in their letters.
I know.
My bad. We will read them on the next recorded podcast. But if you want to send us a letter, preferably in crayon, but it doesn't have to be, you can send your missive to
Warner Archive Podcast, 3400 Riverside Drive, B160-4. Burbank, California, 91522. And also, we're now taking some social media questions. You can send them as a private message. But might I say, send them in letter form, like you're sending a letter, because this one was a little short, and so I'm letting it slide, though, because it's the first one. Podcast question from Brian. Are you still working on trying to get Nothing Lasts Forever for some kind of release? I'm very, very curious, and I don't know what's going to happen with it.
I have been trying for
years.
Let's see. More than two decades to get this film released on home video. There is a long and confusing history behind this movie, including getting its initial theatrical release, but there are some very delicate issues that need to be resolved before the film can be cleared for release, and we have no insight into when that will happen. So at the moment, our hands are tied. We'd love to make it available. We can't, but we thank you for the question, and we are anxious to hear from other people who want to contact us, sending a social media message either through Facebook, private message, or Twitter.
Direct message.
Yes, by all means, contact us and let us know. But if you send a letter and it has a self-addressed stamped envelope, Dan might even send you some swag in return. So that wraps up this Warner Archive Collection podcast, but fear not, we shall return with a slew of new releases of some of your favorites and some things you've never heard of before that you need to discover. Until that time, I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
I'm thrill crazy.
Thanks for listening and look forward to the next Warner Archive podcast.